All right, thank you all for being here for the final talk of the session for this afternoon. This talk is Data in Flight, the Use of Technology in the Urgent Documentation of Bird Data in Mayan Languages. And the presenters are Kerry Hall of Brigham Young University and Rob Fergus from Rowan University.
Thank you. We enjoyed the last presentation a great deal, found a lot of wonderful correlations to our data and our work. There are 30 Mayan languages currently in the world, and the documentation of them has been an ongoing effort linguistically. We've been involved in the documentation of them ethno-ornithologically over the last 20 years. Today we want to report on some of our work in documenting both names as well as ethnographic information in specific Maya groups that we've worked with. We're specifically interested in daily life, ceremonial life, vernacular names, particularly the meaning of calls, and using technology to help in all of these processes. The need to document bird names and accompanying ethnographic information is greater today than it ever has been, as these things are rapidly disappearing. Specifically in our area, where we work in Belize and Guatemala, logging is a major concern. It's changing the environment forever. Birds are disappearing in mass from particular regions, and thereby the knowledge of the birds, their names, and their accompanying ethnographic information disappears with it. The results of these changes and others, such as farming and weather patterns and so forth, and just the expansion of cities in general, it means less human-to-bird contact, and that means language loss and cultural loss. Furthermore, there is a recent trend, was also referenced earlier, to youth not learning a lot of these correlations and ethnographic indicators that have been really important in times past. When a bird says this or does this, it means this. That's rapidly disappearing. So today we want to talk a little bit about nine of the languages that we've worked in, and specifically how technology has helped us in that. So as we've evolved over the last few years in trying to incorporate technology into this process. We've worked with nine languages in Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize, all Mayan languages, and we found some of our best use of technology is in the use of high-resolution digital photographs that we can carry with us on portable devices and use in the field while we're there, specifically videos of birds in flight, since flight patterns are actually quite meaningful, and so depending on how they fly, they'll give a different message. Using digital bird calls has been one of the most effective ways we've had in identifying birds and solidifying the names and so forth, and a lot of the accompanying ethnographic information also. When we speak of ethnographic information, when it comes to birds, we've had a great example of a lot of that in the previous presentation. We're looking at birds as prognosticators primarily, how they prognosticate health, sickness, death, good fortune, bad fortune, all kinds of things. But in terms of agriculture, which is the most important thing here, would be the coming or not coming of the rains, right? This is what birds almost primarily do in these societies. Ethno-ornithology is a field that's fairly new, pretty much in the early 1980s. And as such, as a nascent burgeoning field of study, its importance has been diminished, I think, and looked down upon in some degree until just recently. It is now being used more effectively as a as part of anthropological research in general, as subgenres. And we still feel it has not been given its due in the scholarly literature, but that, I believe, is changing. When we talk about ethno-ornithological data and what is ethno-ornithology, a good definition is the complex interrelations between birds, humans, and all living and non-living things. Where do they fit? And how do they interact with humans and other living beings? Thus, ornithology is broad in its research scope and encompassing both language and nomenclature, in addition to things like mythology, daily life interactions, and so forth, but also conservation. This is a big part of what ethno-ornithology should be about, is the conservation of these ideas, as well as the conservation of the environments where birds can prosper, in fact. By way of an example, let's give you just one here, referring to onomatopoeia, and you guys mentioned that earlier also in your slides. Bird names themselves, as we have documented them, we've documented about 900 different names in the different languages. The vast majority are onomatopoetic across the board. There's a really strong correlation between the way that they sing and the names. Not always, but it's really, really common, probably 70% of the time. This provides an interesting sort of test case. You know, with Saussure's idea of sign and signifier and signified, the notion that there's an arbitrary relationship between the two, well, that doesn't play out, of course, in onomatopoeia, because onomatopoeia is a direct correlation between the sign, or the sound in this case, and the name of the actual bird. So, for example, the golden-fronted woodpecker has two calls in Chorti Maya. The first is wek-wek, and his other one is chaku-chaku, depending on the time of the day and so forth. So both are legitimate names of the bird. But the onomatopoeia behind it is what provides the name for the bird. So this is standard across so many of the Mayan languages. By the way, notice when we're talking about ethnographic data, this is an example of it that I will talk about a little more. Here, it's a sign of death or sickness specifically. Just in terms of technology, as we worked in the maybe 15 years ago in the site of Hokotan, where I do most of my linguistic work, we were there, I don't know, 15 years or so ago, and there were no cell phones. There was one public phone in the square. So they were essentially inaccessible outside of field work. Well, all of that's certainly changed. Now we have so many other options available to us, and we'll talk about some of those today. Cell phone usage is ubiquitous across Guatemala today. Cheap cell phones are everywhere. Smartphones are cheap. And this has really changed the game. We're just now able to, from the comfort of our offices, call a consultant in Hokotan, where before we'd have to populate lists of questions for the next field trip. Now I can call my major consultant that I've been using for 20 years and ask him a question and get an answer almost immediately. So that's a remarkable way that we've been able to, just technology has provided access to very remote villages, for example, in Guatemala. Also the internet, of course, the ability to, for those who have internet access in some of these areas, to send them an audio file, for example, or a photo, or to discuss data that's come up post, you know, field work experience. That has been invaluable to us. We've been able to solidify and work through projects together and collaborate with them on our data. I'm going to turn it over to Rob for a few minutes to talk a little more about technology.
Great. You guys are the strange people who, on a beautiful afternoon in Hawaii, are inside. Thanks for being here. Before I start, anyone else here working with bird data in their communities? Okay, we'll talk in afterwards, I hope, and hopefully this will be useful to lots of other people. One of the main issues that we have, and one of the reasons we started working together, I'm a bird guy and he's the linguist, is making accurate bird identifications is key to really understanding what the data is. And so, for instance, in the Mayan historical records, we find a lot of references to things like pheasants, blue jays, crows, nightingales, things that don't exist in the Mayan area. So we don't have accurate identification for much of the old historical data we have. So you have to go through that and find that again. So that's what we've done, has been fact checking. And when we began, it's obviously being in the field is the best, and getting a visual or an audio of a bird and having an informant tell you what that is, that's the best identification, but it's just not possible to track down everything. So we've in the past relied a lot on field guides, printed images of books, as well as commercial audio products to play the recordings of the birds. And while those continue to be important, there's a lot of new things that are happening that I want to talk about that might be useful to all of us. This is a picture of us when we were up in Tila, Guatemala. We just hopped off the bus and started talking to people. And I'm sorry about the image, it's a little grainy, but I'm holding an iPod and a speaker, and we're just playing bird sounds, and a crowd developed, and we're just going through the names that we're eliciting just from people on the street. It was almost as good as Jay Leno on the street, but it was very much a lot of fun. But in the field, the ability to show color images to native consultants on a smartphone, a phone, or a laptop has made a big difference in our ability to help nail down these different identifications.
A lot of times the Mayan will, they'll know them by their flight or other things that, that you just can't show from a field guide, so those have not been useful. In our work, we've often used just simple technology. Like I said, we started with field guides and audio recordings. We've kind of moved on, though as you can see, that's still very important to us. Sometimes they don't have good vision, so even just, they don't know what birds look like. But they really know what birds sound like, and so one of the things we've really focused on is the sounds and the onomatopoeia of the calls and what those things mean. So what I want to do is show briefly just a couple quick resources that, that have become available recently that even if you don't know much about birds yourself, you could use. The one is the free Merlin app from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. What you can do with this app is you can download a list of pretty much all of the birds that are in your study area. It's made for bird identification, but we've reverse engineered it for our purposes. We can find this bird list, and then you can click on each species, and you can actually show the image of the bird to your informant. And even better than that, then you can actually play the sound on your phone. So here's this clay-colored thrush, and we can just if there's any question, you can play this for your informant and they can tell you what it is. So it's been fantastic. If you can get a picture of the bird on your phone, which is hard, you can actually, it'll help you identify it. And you can have your informants actually download this onto their phone, and they can use it themselves to identify and go through things even when you're not there. So it's a useful tool, and since it's an app, you can download it onto your phone and use it even when you don't have digital or don't have data services out in Guatemala or wherever we are. If you are in a location, maybe you're meeting an informant at a hotel or something where you can get some Wi-Fi, the eBird website is another resource I want to share with you. It's like the Merlin, and it's based on the same resources, but it's much more extensive. You can go and create, again, the list of the birds that are expected in your study area, including when they are found and how obvious they are. This is based on over 100 million bird sightings reported to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology through this eBird app. And then you can click on each species, and once again you can see, but in this case, multiple photographs, and then the video that we were talking about of birds in motion, and then all of the sounds. These are much easier for most of our informants to actually identify than, you know, they look at a field guide with all of the birds and they all look the same. That doesn't look like the birds that they know, but this is how they experience the birds, so it's much more lifelike. So those are two great resources. The third one, if you still need additional bird sounds, the Xenocanto website, it's a crowdsourced place where we have over 100,000 recordings of 99% of the bird species in the world. So if you need additional audio, that's a great place to go to get that. And finally, just, you know, we've used recording devices to record our informants. Well, the quality of the microphone on a smartphone at this point is so good that we can actually use it to record our bird informants as well. In this case, this was a bird that we recorded a couple years ago. We didn't know what it was at the time because we were with our informant out in the jungle.
Hello, emote.
That's me. That's the hello emote. So you can, even if you aren't trained as an ornithologist, you can, with access to this, you can find out what birds are there, and you can elicit information from your informants. You can record the bird and your informant with your phone with this technology that's great. And so I'm going to turn it back over to Carrie for the last couple of minutes.
So one of the other ways that we use technology sometimes, these same bird recordings, is in we play predatory bird calls. So when you're out in the forest, you try to identify it, and you're spending the time to be out there, you want to see the birds so you can make the identifications. So you try to, you know, flush them out. So some using these to play, to cause them to stir, to move, so we can identify them in sight has actually been quite effective. Interestingly, we found that many of our consultants don't need this, and they're able to do this all on their own. Here's an example of one of our Lacandone informants flushing out a bird all on his own here. If that's going to play for us. success, right? So he saw it, it moved, we were able to identify it, and there it was. So. Okay, so we want to take a little step back in time. 5 minutes, we got it. Okay, look a little bit about birds in the ancient past and the classic period of the ancient Maya and see how that informs many of the studies and a lot of the understanding of birds in modern Mayan cultures. Birds as messengers, this is a prominent dominant theme throughout Central America, really everywhere we go, but in Central America it's particularly so. Birds for the classic period Maya were the messengers of the gods par excellence. So for example, this is a really nice example of a plate or a polychrome that was excavated in a tomb in Tikal. And you can actually see a hummingbird here in conversation with Itzamnach, one of the chief gods of the Maya pantheon. And they're having an inner dialogic experience here. And we have the text, and it's a quotative text in first and second person and so forth. So he's speaking to the hummingbird, then the hummingbird goes, gives the messages to the human. So it's a really nice kind of understanding of how this worked in the deep past and is still there today. Our Chontal informants told us specifically that the Tzulu is a messenger of the gods. He is the bird that is given that calling to be the messenger to take messages to Earth. This idea of birds as messengers is a fascinating one, and it goes, it's epigraphically attested, it's iconographically attested. Here's an example of some full-figured glyphs in the Maya hieroglyphic script, spelling out the word umut, which is the possessive form, it is the message of or the bird of. But the same word for bird is also the word for omen in Mayan, especially the Yucatecan branch of the languages. So here, this is a Dresden codex, so this is just pre-Columbian. But each one of those red squared areas is the word mut, which means bird. You can see actually this one is a bird, and it's a metaphorical representation of the omen of, or the burden of the prognostication, which is negative in this case, that they're talking about. And it's spelled out mut, but here it means actually the omen of the, rather than the bird itself. A tertiary meaning is mut as messenger proper. So here's an example from a 7th century polychrome vessel. We have some subordinate lords visiting a super lord. The text says, Eblach mut, which is a positional verb, which says they prostrated themselves. But who is it? It's the mut, it's the messenger. So the messenger is here. So all three meanings of bird, messenger, and omen are part of this. So, and we find all of them in the colonial dictionaries also readily attested. So what kind of information? We'll just finish up with this, give you some quick run through of 5 or 6 kinds of information that are given by birds. The hummingbird is considered one that tells you if a visitor is coming. This is across different cultures we found. So for the Chontal, it's a visitor. If it's the Kekchi, it means someone's coming to ask for your daughter in marriage, so maybe you don't want to be home that day or something, right, depending on the guy. And but it's often a sign of good luck also. The gray-breasted martin is interesting because depending on which language group you're in, it can tell you rain's coming or rain is not coming. So for the Chorti, it is someone who actually summons the rain, right? But for other Maya groups that we worked with, it was somebody that actually tells you that rain is not gonna come. But that's what we found in the Tzutuhil and the Tzeltal. It's saying that the rains are not gonna come if it does certain actions or calls. But in other cases, it's really consistent. And with the clay-colored robin, we found this. So across the Maya region, it's always somebody that will announce or, in fact, bring the rains through his call in a causative sense. The Tzutuhil, the K'el, is a similar one with the barred parakeet. If they meet in a group on a tree and they sing, you know, within 3 or 4 days, you're going to have rain. So these are prognostications. This is communication from birds to humans. And we, with the informants, and they're just straightforward saying, we now know it will rain. And there's no doubt, because these are considered semi-divine prophesiers in their communities. So these are birds are believed. The red lord parrot also, same thing, when they fly over a few times in a group, it means rains are coming soon from the north. That falcon is called the multiplicador de la lluvia. So these are things that bring the rain, and they're going to cause it to be really strong when they appear and sing. The Chorti with the Waco, quite a fascinating one with the laughing falcon. They call it padrino, which is a re-lexicalized term probably from Spanish, but here it means a rain priest. This is the name of the priest that calls the rain, and they are rainmakers themselves. And if they land on a brown branch, it means it's going to be dry weather. If they land on a green branch, it means it's going to be wet. So they prognosticate all through their motions, their landing patterns, as well as their calls, so quite fascinating. I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit. I think we're out of time. We'll finish with the owls. They are, of course, par excellence, the worst of all the birds out there. No one wants to see an owl ever. They always portend something terrible in all Maya groups, and really just, again, pan-regional. I'll give you one final example. This goes back very far in the, this is a pre-Columbian codex also, which talks about this Ikim Kui, this specific owl species in Yucatec. And these are prognostications, and here you can see the guy with the closed eye, he's dead. This is the verb that means to die. So the prognostication is death through the presence of this particular owl. So as we finish, I know our time is up, so I'm just gonna close with this. Knowledge of that we're, the kind of knowledge we're describing today is rapidly disappearing. This sort of encapsulates it for us, this experience with the Chontal Maya. We're talking to the grandfather, the father, the older son, and the younger son, and the difference in knowledge that they had was astounding. The older one knew everything about the birds. The dad knew quite a bit. By the time we got the youngest son, he could barely name three or four birds. Nonetheless, the accompanying ethnographic information. So this was brought into stark contrast for us to the fact that this needs to be documented as soon as possible. So we, according to our research, we found in the Maya area where the birds play an incredibly important role. They are the CNN of the forests, right? This is who they are. They're semi-divine, unlike CNN. And they provide a really powerful set of information, data set, to people that believe in this. And that number is rapidly decreasing at present. But we found that technology has greatly facilitated our research over the last 20 years. Thanks so much.
Fake birds.
So 9 minutes for questions.
Okay. Please. Every bird is different, right? I mean, it really is. For example, in the Tzotzil area, up in the highlands of Guatemala, there's a specific bird they said that it flies high over Lake Atitlan or low Atitlan. That's the sign. So, but this is actually scientific, right? Because it's a question of humidity in the air and how low insects and things fly. But to them, it's not. This is just a straightforward flight pattern giving away the game. So with everyone, it's different. Sometimes there's actual a scientific reason for it that we can trace. Other times at least I don't see it. So every single bird is different, and it'll be cross from one region to the next sometimes.
Yeah, no, of course the scientific reason is only one player.
That's right, exactly. Please.
I'm from Central Oregon, and the word for hawk is similar to ours, lately.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, that's wonderful.
Is that based on how the bird calls?
Yeah, then we have Wiskaka. It's a little bit like that, too, and the meadowlark. The robin. I can't remember what the English name is, but that bird says,
And if you're not documenting the bird names and the messages they give you, you're not documenting part of the language itself. I mean, it's not just getting the names in the language, it's the messages that they bring, that when they say their name. In the case of the laughing falcon, you know, there's taboos against saying its name, or, you know, it says Waco, but you're not, if you say Waco, it'll give you bad breath, because they eat snakes, and so there's some things there. But they are, as you guys mentioned, the birds are part of the community. They're part of the linguistic community. They are speakers of the language in their sense by bringing these messages. So it's been fascinating.
Do you run into any cases where a bird was giving a message not in the language that you were documenting, but in a neighboring one, or different?
I don't know if we've experienced that. We've seen crossover for example, the Kekchi and the Maya, Mopan Maya, who now, as of recently, occupy the same places in Belize, which just hasn't traditionally been the case. We notice a sharing of ideas, and sometimes so one is bleeding from Kekchi, you know, that we can trace that because we found it in the Varapasta regions and so forth. That's what's original there, but not in the other Mopan community. So there's some of that, but I haven't seen one directly otherwise. Okay.
In your experience, is it possible to tell from the call of a bird if it's going to rain or not? Is that something that's, do you feel like it's a acoustically possible to determine, because for the Yak people in southern Alaska, mm-hmm. the raven goes kak, that's just a regular call, but when they hear him go kalak, they say that when you hear him go like that, then it rains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's plenty like that, that the second call will be the one that's actually meaningful for something completely different. Mm-hmm. So for example, with some of the Kiskadees, one call will be it's time for lunch, right? But the other call will mean it's going to rain. And so they're totally distinct calls, they're totally different messages, and they're hearing completely different calls in each case.
I mean, it depends on the temporality. I mean, there's some that are calling, I mean, it's going to rain in the next half an hour. And others are, it's the rainy season, right? So they're announcing the rainy season. So there's different things there. But I have no doubt that some of the even micro temporality things are accurate for some of these people.
Because the way it was described is that its throat is wet. So I'm thinking, well, it could have something to do
that's
with
interesting,
humanity
yeah.
or something.
Right. Yeah.
I just wanted to share that I've done work in Australia, and the bird identification that we do a lot with the traces. So we photograph all the little footprints.
The footprints?
Okay. Because of this, they often leave trace in the sand and so on. So that this is used a lot for identifying the birds, more than the actual picture.
Oh, wow.
Are these birds that they are hunting, so they're tracking, or they just they read
not
the
necessarily,
sign?
Just okay. all of them.
All right.
Eventually
yeah.
end up on the ground, and we take pictures of their footprints.
Are you in an arid area, or is it wet?
Well, it's quite wet, but still, that's...
They're still able
yeah,
to,
yeah.
Interesting. We haven't
got lots
that
of
yet,
photos of footprints.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, not footprints, but...
It's like the birds are actually writing, and they're reading a sign, you know?
Yeah,
it's like
absolutely. All the time, when you walk with people, they're always
right.
showing you who's been around.
Yeah, that's
mm-hmm.
fascinating.
So I worked with the Macaulay Library, the sound library there,
mm-hmm.
for identifying birds. And I just remember, you know, I'd listen to all the sounds. Some recordings are a lot better than others. And they mentioned that you have to be careful about the area that a single species, the song will vary in different areas. And I just wondered how precise, how much you want to match the sound file, you know, where it was obtained,
mm.
the area you're researching. Are there certain birds that vary much more, and is it just totally idiosyncratic?
Yes. Sometimes it's hard, and that's why getting an actual recording that you yourself can take home and try to verify, like that Amui Moot, which was the one that I recorded, I'm still not 100% sure on that one, because just, you know, all of the files that I've matched, I'm close on those nightingale thrushes, but which one exactly, it's...
And is their song very varied?
Oh yeah, and different subspecies will have different
right.
ones to you. So I have to compare ones from Mexico and even to the same state if possible, because
yeah.
even a couple states over, it might be very different.
Yeah, thanks. These resources you mentioned, do they cover birds like worldwide, or are they restricted?
So eBird is worldwide completely. So you know we could pull up the Solomon Islands right now. We could get the list of the birds of the Solomon Islands. You'll have pictures. You'll have sound. The Merlin Free app covers almost all of the New World. It covers Europe, and they're expanding it to other parts of the Old World. So it's not quite as comprehensive yet, but. The way I used to work with Audubon was a partner on this with Cornell, and the way they work, it's going to be global soon.
And then the follow-up question is there a resource to get pictures of birds that are non-proprietary that can be used in like a picture dictionary that you know of?
So that's something we've been interested in, because like the other thing is how do we just, you know, take this information back to the communities and make it into, you know, either apps or posters or, you know, things that we can use. And we don't have one yet. However, you know, there are a lot of free ones out there. The pictures that are included in eBird, it'll tell you who the photographer is, and so you can contact them and try to get permission. So that's one place to start. I know it's very difficult because I'm working on a publication in Europe, and the copyright laws are so strict there. I can't even use open source pictures because they won't allow it. I have to get permission. So that is it is difficult. But you know, starting with that eBird website is a good place because it's the Macaulay Library's collection. But the photographers themselves have them, and you can contact them.
Yeah, there was a database in Philadelphia.
vireo, but this is so much bigger now.
I contacted Sophie Ramos, and she was willing to let me use her drawings in my work, you know, publish them online. And the problem is the plates, and you'd have to do it, but
right.
Some artists are, you know, they're not, if it's nonprofit and if educational stuff like that, they will give you their.
But with digital photography, there are so many digital photos out there now that you can get pictures. It's just you have to poke around. And there isn't like the free picture database necessarily that I know of.
So we're just out of time, but since it's the end of the session, if people want to stick around and continue the discussion.
Thanks for sticking around, guys.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, we have it. I mean, we're using it for a completely different purpose.